Hello, hello. Welcome to Be Bold America. I'm your host, Jill Cody. Today our program is Inequality Kills Us All, the complex answer to why the United States does so poorly in health measures has, at its base, one pervasive issue. The United States has by far the highest levels of inequality of all the rich countries. In his book, Inequality Kills Us All, Dr. Stephen Bezruschka details how living in a society with entrenched hierarchies increases the negative effects of illnesses for everyone. He also states that health in the United States is not what should be expected for such a rich country, one that spends a fortune on medical care. We have big things to do. Dr. Stephen Bezruschka is the author of Inequality Kills Us All, COVID-19's Health Lessons for the World, and he is an associate teaching professor emeritus in the departments of health systems and population health and of global health at the University of Washington School of Public Health. Due to decades as an emergency physician, a public health expert, and as years of community health experience in Nepal, Dr. Bezruschka looks at our country as the patient in need of treatment. Dr. Bezruschka, welcome to Be Bold America.
Thank you very much, Jill. It's a pleasure to be here.
It is our pleasure. And the first thing I wanted to check in with you on is, am I pronouncing your last name correctly?
Bezruschka. It's a hard C-H. It's a Ukrainian name. It means without a little hand.
Oh.
Bezruschka.
Bezruschka. Okay, I will do my best to say that properly. Well, maybe a place to start. How healthy are we in the United States?
So we have to define what health means in order to answer that question. And as an emergency doctor in the ER, the easiest diagnosis I could make was that somebody was dead. You know, that's hard to fake. So I would then fill out a death certificate, and it would be sent to the state, and they would take that person's birth certificate and death certificate and tally how many years they lived. If you do that for a state or a country, that's called life expectancy. If mortality rates didn't change, that's the average length of life in a country. So if we think of our own personal vital signs, you know, we go to see a healthcare worker and they'll measure our pulse, blood pressure, temperature, weight, things like that. Those are individual vital signs. And I would offer that how long we live, life expectancy, is an appropriate vital sign for a country. So we all know when we go to see the doctor what a normal blood pressure is or what a normal temperature is. So what's a normal life expectancy, a vital sign for a country? Well, it should be what the best countries achieve. In other words, what's normal should be what's achievable. So I came to realize back in the late 1980s that taking life expectancy as a measure of health, the United States was behind so many other countries, and I couldn't understand it. Because I went to I became a doctor because I wanted to do something that was useful, and medical care in this country was touted as the best in the world. We certainly were spending a lot of money at it. And so when I discovered that we didn't live that long when the standard where the standard was comparing ourselves to other countries, I had to figure out why.
Well, we don't. It's interesting because comparing ourselves to another country, but even comparing what one would call blue states versus red states, I just read recently that life expectancy in red states was 66.8 years. And in blue states, it was 86.8 years. It's a 20-year difference. Can you tell us more about the difference even within our own country?
So, yes. If we look, say, at U.S. counties, let's take that distinction. And in the book, I show a graph of life expectancy at the U.S. county level, page 115, for 2019. And they go from dark shades to being low life expectancy to light shades being high life expectancy. And the lowest life expectancy in the country is on Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota. And the highest life expectancy is not that far away in Summit County and a couple of other rich counties in Colorado. So that represents a 30-year difference, sort of what you're talking about between so-called red states and blue states. So that's a huge difference. If you take Pine Ridge, for example, their health outcomes are comparable to one of the worst-off African countries. In other words, health stratifies from the longest-lived country, Japan, down to the least healthy country, depending on which year you look at, it's Chad or some country like that. And that's a huge difference. Trying to explain that is then the next challenge. Why do we live about 7.5 years shorter lives than Japan? Japan being the longest lived country, has been since 1978. Well, we would tend to think it's our personal behaviors. I used to believe that. I used to blame my patients in the emergency department for the smoking or drinking or shooting up they did as the reasons for their poor health. But I discovered that in Japan has three times as many men smoking as in the United States these days. And if they can be the healthiest, the longest-lived country in the world, that suggests that smoking cigarettes may not be the reason for Japan's good health. So I had to probe elsewhere, and eventually I came in upon the studies that showed that income inequality was related to a country's health outcomes, mortality outcomes, life expectancy. The first studies came out in 1979, and to date, there have been 400 or 500 studies on many different populations over different time periods by different investigators showing the link between income inequality and worse health. And I could delve into that. Today's New York Times talks about mass shootings, issue of Sunday Opinion. The front page is just headlines from the paper of various mass shootings. Well, if you define a mass shooting as four victims or more per event, then we have studies linking income inequality at the local level, along with the presence of rich people, to mass shootings. So, I came away with the idea that if we focus on what's the upstream cause of what's going on in society, inequality is probably the leading contender. I quote Amartya Sen, a Nobel Prize-winning economist, who says, I believe that virtually all the problems in the world come from inequality of one kind or another.
Well, your inequality is a issue that's very important to me, too. And I take a look at when Reagan started in 1981 and his policies that are continuing to today, have gutted the American working class and exploded inequality in this nation. And it's been 50 years now, $50 trillion have been moved. Since Reagan took office, $50 trillion with a T has been moved to
That's
the 1%.
Right.
So
That's right.
it's more inequality than, we're the most unequal developed country in the entire world. And in addition, three multi-billionaires own as much wealth as the bottom half of Americans. So for people to get their arms wrapped around the inequality in this country, another example is one single millennial billionaire owns more wealth than all other millennials in America combined. and that's Mark Zuckerberg. So I, you know, when we talk about inequality, I just want all of us to understand the greatness of it, or the monstrosity of it. Your thoughts?
So I think the challenge is, you know, most of us have a hard time conceptualizing $1 million, let alone 50 trillion. So one way that I like to try and make this realistic is if we take a somebody who has $250 billion, that's sort of the highest wealth around today. And if we stacked it in $100 bills from the ground up, it would reach about a third of the way to the moon. That's how much one person has in terms of wealth.
So again, it's $1 trillion would be $250 billion, which would be, what, $250,000 million?
Yeah. I mean, this is staggering. You know, I used to be a mathematician, and I can deal with these large numbers. But for most of us, it's hard to think, to conceptualize more than 100.
Well, you blew
my...
Well, you blew my mind when you talked about not our personal behaviors. I mean, it's not that they don't have an impact on our health, correct? It's just that the impact on America's health is greater with inequality. Is that what I'm hearing?
Much, much, much greater, yes. I mean, if Japan can be the longest-lived country and much more equal than we are, and yet it has three times as many men smoking, that doesn't compute.
Right.
So, yes, you know, I do all the right things as an individual to try and be healthy, but it pales in comparison with the country in which I live. You know, if you have a choice and you want to smoke, be born in Japan. It doesn't help to move to Japan as a smoker, but it would be better to be born there. That said, if the Japanese men stopped smoking, they would live even longer. So it's important, just not that important.
They could live to 125, or considering...
Well, yes, that's an interesting way of judging our health. The oldest old person at any one time, the person who has lived the longest, is never in the United States. They typically hail from Japan. The oldest woman there died last year at 119 years.
That's a very interesting way to put it, that we've never had the oldest person alive in the world in the United States. That says everything. You're listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM. Many voices, one station. Listen globally online from the KSQD.org website. Our topic today is Inequality Kills Us All, and we're speaking with Dr. Stephen Bezrutska. Did I say that right?
You did.
Oh, good. Bezrutska.
Thank you. Yeah.
The author of Inequality Kills Us All, and he is a teaching professor emeritus at the University of Washington and serves on the Washington Board of Physicians for Social Responsibility. I'm your host, Jill Cody.
Hello, K-Squid listeners. I'm Todd Hartman, and each weekday at 4 p.m., I bring you a different perspective on the news than you're likely to hear on most media outlets. Please join me on KSQD Santa Cruz, your ink spot on the dial for the Tom Hartman program, heard now for the first time ever in the Monterey Bay Area at 90.7 FM, weekdays at 4 p.m. That's Progressive Talking Conversation with me, Tom Hartman, weekdays at 4 p.m. on KSQD 90.7 FM. Tag, you're it.
We're back. Would you like a friend to hear Dr. Stephen Bezrutska's interview? Be Bold America is available as a podcast. Subscribe for free for any podcast platform. Now, Doctor, what are poverty perspectives? In the book, you write about a great quote from Robert Sapolsky from his book, Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. And it's if you want to increase your chances of avoiding stress-related diseases, make sure you don't inadvertently allow yourself to be born poor. And I would think it's also true if you want to increase your chance of avoiding stress is to have been born in Finland, Denmark, and Iceland. On the happiness quotient, we're 16th out of 20.
Yes.
So what are the poverty perspectives?
So what we have to recognize is that poorer people have poorer health. Anywhere you look, that's going to be true. And, of course, you have to come up with a definition of poverty. You have to look at data. The point that I like to make about recognizing that is the tragedy of the sinking of the Titanic. You know, back in, I think it was 1917 or something like that. If you had a first-class ticket, 60% survived. If you had a second-class ticket, it was 45% survived. If you were third-class or crew, 25%. Lesson there, always get a first-class ticket on the Titanic. But that represents pretty well everything you need to know. That's why Sapolsky said, don't allow yourself to be born poor.
Well, that is a wonderful example. I didn't know that. So you also write about early life lasts a lifetime. What does that mean?
So again, this is something that I had to sort of redirect my thinking about. Basically, as we go from the erection to the resurrection, it's the first 1,000 days after conception when roughly half of our health as an adult is programmed. So why might that be so? Well, think of the first 9 months. The fetus is sitting, well, let's backtrack one. The main purpose for humans in our lifetimes is to reproduce so the species doesn't die out. So that we're here to reproduce, and after that, our job is done. And so we may die young, but as long as we've reproduced, the species won't die out. So the fetus is sitting in a womb, being given information from the mother through stress hormones and things like that of how much stress the mother is facing while she's pregnant. And if it's a stressful environment, the stress hormones program the fetus to survive to reproduce. The fetus may be born early, be born of low birth weight, and it's out there fighting to make sure that it survives to reproduce. And in that process, it makes compromises in its physiology. Namely, I'll die in my 60s with diabetes or high blood pressure, but as long as I've had a baby, given that you're a female, that's what you do. So studies looking at the first 9 months in the womb and the next 2 years, that adds up to 1,000 days, show that your outcomes really depend on the factors during that time period. And this devolves to recognizing that, you know, who's responsible for those first 1,000 days? Well, you can't put that responsibility on a 1 or a 2-year-old, and you can't put it on the fetus. Here we tend to blame the mother if her baby isn't doing well. But no, the mother has relatively little control, especially if she's poor. So we have to recognize that it's the conditions in society that matter. And what do I mean by that? Well, for example, being a good parent takes time and money. And where are you going to get the time? There are only 2 countries in the world that don't give a working woman who's pregnant paid time off after she has her baby. One is, of course, the United States. We say we can't afford it. And the other is half of a big island north of Australia, Papua New Guinea.
My.
Only 2 countries in the world without a nationally mandated paid maternity leave. Take a country like Sweden, which is much, much, much healthier than the United States. 444 days of mandated paid parental leave is the situation there. And the father has to take 13 weeks, and you get your full pay. In the next, so that's about a year and a half. After that, when your child And you can get the rest of the second year is optional at only 70% pay. Then in your child's third year, you can put that you can put your now 3 year old in a Swedish government run daycare center that's free. And the requirements to work in a Swedish government run daycare center is you have an advanced degree in play. Because what's daycare? It's socializing the kid, not an infant anymore. And you want experts there. You know, what are our requirements to work in a daycare center? Well, the ability to work at minimum wage or sometimes even less. So you get what you pay for. I mean, Sweden spends more government money on the first year of life than in any subsequent year. We spend our money on trying to rehabilitate so-called juvenile delinquents in their teenage years. So we don't put the money where it's really going to matter.
Well, you're talking about, you know, government also being concerned about morality, I think, because to me it is immoral to what we do to our young mothers and mothers that are struggle financially. We don't give the prenatal care that is required, nor do we have, as you mentioned, the national mandated maternity leave. None of that happens here.
Yeah.
So why is that? I guess that gets to your point about the politics, that our health depends on our political choices.
So that's the hardest thing to come to grips with, that the political choices we make determine the conditions in society through which good health happens, as if by some a variety of processes that we're not aware of, such as paid parental leave or income inequality. And then there's medical care, too. One of the problems is so many Americans conflate the terms health and health care. We speak of accessing health, paying for health, getting health, ensuring health. And that makes us think that that health is obtained by all of these processes, when in fact we're accessing health care, paying for health care, getting health care, ensuring health care. So one of the first things that we need to do is to recognize the difference between health and health care. We should ask the question, do we want health or health care? Ideally, we should have both. We're the only rich country without a universal health care program. Yet we spend almost half of the world's health care bill to achieve this, and more money that the government spends than in countries that have universal health care. So we're already spending enough to have universal health care, but for some reason there's a resistance in this country to wanting to do that. Yes, some politicians talk about it, but back in the days of the legislation for the Affordable Care Act, our president said, single payers off the table. So
I remember
my
that.
So why is it that we don't want to have everybody to have access to health care when they need it? Not that health care is that important. I mean, it can't be, given that we spend so much and have so little. But it's what everybody thinks is important, so we should have it. And part of the reason is, you know, the health care is not considered a right in this country, a universal right. And that's exemplified, for example, by the many states not taking the Medicaid option to fund better Medicaid, that is, medicine for the poor, in their states. There seems to be a resistance to that, sometimes hard to sort of imagine. Why would states decide to not take up the Medicaid supplements? Bizarre.
Well, it also, health insurance companies, hospitals, and pharmaceutical manufacturers, they've all morphed from regional and competitive organizations into giant monopolistic predators, if you will. The profit margins they have. I mean, before Nixon signed the 1973 bill that opened the door for profit HMOs, I mean, before that, it was nonprofits. But now it is a big, big business and big, big donors to individuals in Congress. So what's your thoughts about how the privatization has of the insurance companies, the hospitals, the pharmaceutical manufacturers has affected our health in this country?
So we have a big lobbying sector, and there, I think there are five healthcare lobbyists for every person in Congress. And until very recently, the biggest expenditure for lobbying, you know, lobbyists have to be registered when they're in D.C., was for healthcare insurance and the pharmaceutical companies and all the rest of them. So this is an interesting process. These lobbyists can wine and dine legislators and do a whole bunch of other things to get them to support this medical industrial complex. And we have international students that come for to our global health department. And when I speak with them and I describe this situation of lobbying in the United States, I ask them what this would be called in their country. And they all say, oh, that's corruption.
Yes.
The only difference in the United States is corruption is legal.
It's legal.
Yeah.
Oh, we have a Supreme Court that really helped that along. You're listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM. Many voices, one station. Listen globally online from the KSQD.org website. Would you like to be added to our news group and get advance notice of our upcoming interviews? If so, please text Be Bold America at 22828. Text Be Bold America at 22828. And if you signed up already, just a big hug and thank you to you. And we are speaking with Dr. Stephen Bezruchka, author of Inequality Kills Us All, COVID-19's Health Lessons for the World. To learn more, visit Stephen with a PH, S-T-E-P-H-E-N, Bezruchka, B-E-Z-R-U-C-H-K-A .com. Dr. Bezruchka, I normally play at this point in the show a two-minute, two-and-a-half-minute Jim Hightower commentary that would relate to a topic currently being discussed, but today, instead, I wanted to play you a two-and-a-half-minute clip from Chris Hayes's, just this week, on January 25th, MSNBC program. The clip starts at the eulogy of Diamond, of the Diamond and Silk duo, who are conservative streamers, and then ends with Tucker Carlson of Fox News. And Doctor, I just wanted, please listen, I would like to get your take on the other side.
Okay.
Now, Diamond died earlier this month, reportedly of heart disease, and her sister, the other half of the Diamond and Silk duo, turned her eulogy for her sister at this event into a rant against COVID vaccines, complete with some weird misinformation about how the vaccine is killing people.
Instead of asking if Americans are vaxxed or unvaxxed, the real question to ask is, are Americans being poisoned? Technically, and according to the science, it doesn't matter if you're vaxxed or not. As long as the gain of function allows one injected person to transfer and infect another person, and that person infect another person, eventually everyone will be affected in one way or the other. People are dropping dead around here, and nobody's talking about it. The catchphrase is SAD, S-A-D, sudden adult death syndrome. Many call it a conspiracy theory. I call it murder.
Okay, now, first things first, that's not true. It doesn't even really cohere. The gain-of-function reference is to gain-of-function research. But to folks who travel in some conservative circles, the idea that the COVID vaccine is like jumping from person to person, even people that haven't gotten the vaccine, and by so doing, like through the air, causing masses of otherwise healthy people to suddenly drop dead, is basically treated as canon, as outlandish as that is. I mean, really, this is a mainstream belief among the far right in this country. It was particularly notable earlier this month when right-wingers immediately either said or implied that Damar Hamlin, the Buffalo Bills safety who had to be rushed to the hospital after he suffered a cardiac arrest on the field after a tackle to his chest, that he was actually the victim of heart disease caused by the vaccine.
Hamlin was still lying on the field receiving CPR when self-described medical experts in the media, people with no demonstrated medical ethics at all, effectively witch doctors, decided to use his tragic life-threatening injuries as an opportunity to spread still more propaganda about the COVID shots. It could not have been the shot, they told you. Shut up. But they're lying. They don't know that.
Doctor, Chris Hayes stressed several times through that program that this is an uncontroversial view on the far right. And how can we get the truth to 30% of the country who are entrenched in this disinformation and so entrenched that it's almost a religion, it's beyond an ideology? And are you doing any interviews on right-wing radio or TV?
No, I don't think I've had any like that. There's a real problem with factual understanding in this country. What is a fact? Well, there are, you have your facts, I have my facts, and about a quarter of Americans think the sun goes around the earth. A large fraction of millennials think the earth is flat. And among countries, we have about the lowest proportion of people believing in evolution. Study in science back, I think, in 2007.
We're going backwards. We're just going backwards.
Yeah. So that was then. And now I think part of the problem is there are too many outlets through social media to tailor whatever belief you have and find sources on social media to validate that. And we don't teach science in schools. Creationism is on the curriculum in quite a few schools. The moon landing was considered a hoax. And so we can sort of believe anything we can and find support for those beliefs. So getting down to your question about the COVID vaccine.
Right.
We've had over 1,100,000 deaths from COVID in the United States so far, a little more than that. And that is more than any other country in the world. As I said in the beginning, it's hard to fake a death, and I think we can be pretty sure of people dying from COVID. And so, and yes, we're a large population, so we should look at rates divided by the population size. And if we do, we're somewhere in the top 10 in terms of rates of death from COVID. Well, COVID is suppose back in 2019, somebody said, the next couple of years you're going to be impacted by a contagion that nobody's ever heard of before, and it's going to wreak havoc in the country. You would have been wise to say, that's nonsense. But this has been predicted for 10, 15 years. And what should we do under such circumstances? Well, we should strengthen public health departments. We should strengthen the Centers for Disease Control and Function. We should improve our ties with the World Health Organization. But our previous president cut funding for the World Health Organization, and we've been defunding public health in this country with a vengeance, partly because we see no benefit from that. I mean, they work to keep our water clean and to keep fecal matter out of food and stuff like that. So they're in the background. And it's like the political factors that we talk about that affect our health. They're sort of in the background, but they're the most important. And the political factors that matter most are what we decide as a people in a democracy to support or fund. Do we fund the rich with a vengeance as we're doing right now? I mean, that we can't get, this, you go back to Reaganomics in 1981, Reagan said, give the rich as much as they can possibly hold, and something will trickle down to us, and we'll be better off. David, I forget his name right now, was his economic advisor. And people bought it. Imagine that.
I know.
I'm gonna have less so the rich can have more, and it'll be better for me.
Right. And he also raised taxes on the working class 11 times.
Right. Well, so let's rewind to a better time.
Yes. Let's rewind.
So in 1942, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt wanted to have a maximum wage for the United States. And I show people a cover, the front page of the April 28th, 1942 New York Times, and the lead headline is $25,000 income limit asked by president. So Roosevelt proposed 100% tax on all incomes above $25,000. That is the highest marginal tax rate would kick in at $25,000. So if you made another dollar, all of it would go to the government. Well, that didn't pass. But in 1944, a 94% tax passed. That's close enough. And in 1946, that was raised to 96%, the highest marginal tax rate. And then in the 1950s, it got whittled down to 91%. Now, during the 1950s, we were one of the longest-lived countries in the world, and we had much, much, much less inequality then. The tax rate, the highest marginal tax rate went down to the 70s and 60s, 40s, and then Reagan pushed it down into the 30s, and that's where it's been ever since. This is killing us.
It's killing us, and it has been, I think, intentional. I can't remember, it was Kirk who wrote the Conservative Mind. I forget his first name, but he and his colleagues like William F. Buckley, you know, they felt that if the middle class and minorities became too wealthy, they'd feel the safety and freedom and throw themselves actively into political process as rich people had control over that. So they really didn't want the middle class to get too strong. And before, I think, before Reagan, 65% of America's population was in the middle class. Now it is 45%.
Yes.
Yes.
So, I hearken back to the 1960s when I came of age then. And we had the protests against the invasion of Vietnam. We have the civil rights movement. We had the democracy trials in Chicago.
Birth control.
Universities.
Women's movement, birth control.
Birth control, right. Yes. Soon afterwards, Roe v. Wade. So I was at Harvard when my roommate was escorted out of University Hall leading the Harvard bust. So I was a part of all of that. Mm. So what was the response? And similar things are going on in Western Europe and in East Asia. That is, people were protesting, taking democracy seriously. So the Trilateral Commission, made up of Western Europe, East Asia, and North America, convened a meeting and produced a report published in 1975. The title of the report was The Crisis of Democracy. And in the report, they write that if the events of the 1960s kept on going, it could lead to an excess of democracy. We could have too much democracy, and we'd need to sort of put in place policies to cool it down. 1975. Zbigniew Brzezinski, Carter's national security advisor, was the lead writer on that. And Carter, for all his efforts, nevertheless ushered in neoliberal transformation. So, the rich and powerful do not want democracy. I mean, the only thing they ever want is more. And they've been very good at getting that. And we're left with the crumbs. And, but the power of the people is greater than the power of the people in power. We just have to recognize that. We have to come together collectively, decide what we want. I mean, I don't know about you, but I would rather live a longer life than a shorter one. And our shorter lives aren't even that healthy or happy. You know, our happiness has been plummeting as a country. And actually, women are taking it on the lam as well. Happiness is declining more in women than in men. In the book, I have a graph of female life expectancy at age 50 from 1955 to 2007. And I have just six countries there: Japan, United States, France, Spain, Australia, and Italy. Back in 1955, American women had the most years of life to look forward to at age 50 than any of the other five countries. And Japanese women had the least. And then we move on to 2007, and the American women were firmly in the race until about 1980, and then they fell behind the other countries. And Japanese women raced on ahead to become the longest-lived people in the world. Nobody touches Japanese women for health. So why did American women fall behind after 1980? Well, a lot of it had to do with the Reagan Revolution and the expectations on women in this country. Women had to be devoted moms, loving wives, have a successful career, have the looks of a supermodel, the physique of a jock. Oh, that's impossible. But those were the expectations on American women, and they got no support. You know, the other countries, like I mentioned, Sweden, or they had paid leave for being parents, and much more support in terms of being able to be effective mothers. And in Germany, United States is the only rich country with no vacations, no nationally mandated vacations. And, it's just another example of how we fall behind other countries. So, in addition to being dead first, we are the no vacation nation, and a whole bunch of other monikers like that. I mean, I try to come up with succinct, short statements that grab people and make them say, huh, what did he say? And then you can explore that.
Well, you just related my life as a young mother, working professional, and I would add to that, having also responsible for the perfect house and cleaning and being the social director for the family and for the child and arranging the child care. And I grew up during those years, and it was amazingly stressful that I still think I carry in my cells somewhere.
Yeah.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Dr. Stephen Bezruka, the author of Inequality Kills Us All, and who is an associate teaching professor emeritus at the University of Washington. I'm your host, Jill Cody.
Join KSQD this evening at 6 for Cats on Dogs, Insights for Both Ends of the Leash with your host, Lori Katz. Lori is a certified professional dog trainer, and each month she welcomes another dog expert to offer advice to you and your canine companions. That's Cats on Dogs, tonight at 6 p.m. here on KSQD 90.7 FM and KSQD.org. Many voices, one station.
Dr. Bezruka, I want to move into what we can do, what we could keep doing and stop doing and start doing, but I still had a couple more questions. And one of the things that you wrote in your book is, why do Americans tolerate such little public spending on the items that we've been talking about, health and child care and prenatal care and on and on? Why do we tolerate it?
Because public spending means that You didn't do it yourself. Somebody helped you. And we believe we're a country of individuals, and you get what you work hard to obtain. Forget that the rich, you know, the rich don't abide by that. They get bailouts. Remember the banking crash in 2007 and 8?
Yes.
None of the bankers went to jail. They got bailouts. But in a country of supposed individuals, for example, Arlie Hochschild studied this in the Southeast, and she said, people who got welfare looked like they were stepping ahead of others in the line. So the word welfare is a four-letter word in this country. So we believe that the government's helping us is bad. And it's actually somewhat, it's hard to believe, because all the other rich countries have strong welfare support systems. But something's really askew in this country. And what this does, when you have to do it all yourself, and you can't do it yourself, and you blame yourself, well, how do you get through the day? Well, one way is to take opioids. We consume 3/4 of the world's opioids in this country. Imagine that. So we have a lot of pain in this country. And pain comes in two flavors, physical pain and social pain. And both are effectively helped by opioids, and we have a lot of social pain in this country. And studies show that we have more pain than people in the other rich countries. And that's because of the stress we're under. You know, I say stress is the 21st century tobacco, and it's killing us. And I think medicating us, you know, we have all these huge, we have over 100,000 deaths now from opioids a year, and the number keeps increasing. And that's just a talisman of the amount of stress we're under and the various ways we try and cope. And some maybe good ways of coping, you know, exercise and that sort of meditation, but opioids mostly are not good for us.
You know, this is just simply tragic, what's happening in this country. I see why you now look at America as needing the treatment. You know, stress is killing our country.
Yes. So how are we going to treat it?
Yes. So do you have some keep, stop, start so we can help you, help do that? You have two chapters in your book of action items, one titled Prescription Needed, and the other is What Can We Do? So what can we keep doing, stop doing, and start doing for ourselves and to help change the country so we value our health and our health care?
So the most important thing is to recognize that our health comes from political choices we make. And the choices have to do basically with how we structure early life and who gets what share of the pie. And being at least a nominal democracy, we can make those choices. So what are you going to do to make America healthy again? Remember, we were one of the healthiest countries back in the 1950s. And now, in what I call the Health Olympics, 43 countries, including all the other rich ones, have longer lives than we do. So I tell my students this. I say, do what you enjoy, because if you don't enjoy it, you're not going to do it for long. Do what you have skills for. You know, I'm not very good on social media, but I try to write and I teach and I go to as many different venues to present these ideas as I can, and I develop skills for them. And one of those skills is going to grade 6, 7, 8. If you can go into a grade 6, 7, or 8 classroom, that's, you know, that you have a better chance of changing people's minds than when they've ossified in their 60s and 70s. So I try to get into as many different situations as I can. I recognize that people of my age, they have a lot of life experiences, so I try to reach out for them. I give courses at retirement centers on this. The other important thing is, so do what you enjoy, do what you have skills for, and do what you can do for a long time without being paid much. There's no occupational category in this country to make America healthy again. You're not going to be paid to do it. It's something we're going to have to do basically by getting the word out. That is, hardly anybody recognizes what we've been talking about, namely, we die younger and push up daisies much sooner than we should. So we have to create that awareness. And that's really difficult. It's sort of like global warming. You know, the temperature is slowly rising and sea levels are going up, but it's a slow process and you're not aware of it. And most Americans think it's, well, I shouldn't say most, but our declining health and increasing inequality is that slow process comparable to global warming. So we have to get the word out. Now, we don't have the sentinel events that can do this really rapidly. You know, I remember in 1957, the Russians launched the satellite, Sputnik, into space. And it beamed a signal down to Earth, and it was all over the newspapers. And we were aware, my God, what's going on? You know, we're way behind in the space race. So that, people who were cognizant in 1957 realized the Russians were ahead of us, and we had to do something. So we launched a goal to land a human on the moon by the end of the 1960s, and we were successful. So countries have goals, and we need to recognize that we have to do something about being dead first and set a goal to become the healthiest country in 40, 50 years. The only way that we can become the healthiest country in a few years is if we nuke all about 44 other countries or 43 other countries, and that would destroy everything. So that's not an option. But countries can set goals. And as I said, our goal right now is to make the rich richer. And we could change that goal. The next thing we need to do, so, you know, like we talked about with the mass shootings, the media doesn't focus on what's the most upstream causative factor. I mentioned mass shootings occur where there's a lot of inequality and great wealth. And so that requires changing our inequality if you want to deal with mass shootings. And that's not being discussed. The other thing we need to do is to distinguish health and health care. That is, we need to recognize how little health care actually does to produce health. And that's tough, too. You got to get into grades 5, 6, and 7 and start to present. So I had a student. She developed a curriculum for grade 6 on the ideas that we're talking about, and she piloted it in 2 classes daily for a month. And she got, she got feedback, evaluations, showing that the students' minds had really changed considerably in that process.
You know, that leaves us, I wish we could go on and on because this is a fascinating topic. And I'd like to leave on that positive note. So, Dr. Bezruska, thank you for being our bold and impressive guest today. It's been enlightening and instructive, and spending some time with you on air has been wonderful from all the different data and the Titanic example. You're doing such valuable work. Keep it up, and thank you for writing this book.
Thank you for having me, Jill. It's been great.
Well, it's been our honor. Remember to pick up Dr. Bezruska. Brilliant book, Inequality Kills Us All. And you may learn more at Stephen, spelled with a PH, Bezruchka, BEZRUCHKA.com. What's next on Be Bold America? Please join us on Sunday, February 12th, when we will be talking about the Kuni Manifesto, The Time for Kuni is Now. As we despair about shrinking rural areas and are intimidated by cities growing to monstrous scale, where are we supposed to go? We are dazzled by image, enslaved by fads, and compelled to buy, buy, buy. Kuni offers a unique model for the revitalization of rural and de-industrialized lands and communities and shares lessons in citizen-led regeneration for all of us, regardless of where we live. Also, for the next show, there'll be a guest host for the topic on Kuni. Christine Barrington, one of our wonderful KSQD Talk of the Bay talk show hosts, will be conducting this interview. This is a perfect topic for Christine because she is dedicated to a positive transformation, and Kuni is a brilliant method in achieving it. Find out what Kuni is. The idea and concept comes from Japan, our longest living, as we just learned, longest living country. By listening to Be Bold America on Sunday, February 12th at 5 p.m. to hear the Kuni Manifesto, The Time for Kuni is Now. As a reminder, Be Bold America is available as a podcast. Now you may listen to the show anytime for free by subscribing through your favorite podcast platform, such as Apple, Google, and Spotify. I want to give a special thank you to our bold guest, Dr. Stephen Bezruka, and also to our program engineer, Eliza James, and our station's program director, Howard Feldstein. You're listening to KSQD Santa Cruz, many voices, one station. Listen worldwide online at ksqd.org. Stay tuned for a special live Cats on Dogs show. My name is Jill Cody, and thank you for listening to Be Bold America. Until next time, keep, stop, start.